Cheers to my fellow sports fans out there. This is Kent Batty, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading from the USA Today Sports Weekly, bringing us the sports news of the week, June 18th through 24th, 2025, of course. Today's cover story is Worst to First. We rank 8 NFL teams' chances to pull off the feat. But it's baseball season, so I'm going to start with a few baseball stories. The first is the leading off column, which this week is by Gordon Wittenmeyer. Ellie De La Cruz mostly puts his head down and goes to work when he gets to the ballpark before games. He doesn't wear emotions on his sleeve, and especially the past 2 weeks, has kept more to himself. It's only when you get close enough to see the heart he wears on his cap next to his sister's name that you're reminded of the emotional weight he carries. We were all already in awe of Ellie, teammate Brent Suter said. The stuff that he does every day, the kind of teammate he is, the kind of guy he is, the kind of player he is. But this is just taking it to a whole new level. It was after the May 31st game in Chicago when De La Cruz learned that his sister, Janelis De La Cruz Sanchez, a mother of two, had died after a lengthy illness. He stayed to himself the next morning at the ballpark, declined to speak with media, and didn't share the news with many of his teammates. Then he played, hit a home run, gestured to his heart and the skies as he crossed the plate, and kept playing. And in perhaps the most mentally demanding big league sport to play, he has somehow managed to perform better than he has all year, leaving teammates with little explanation for how. I don't know how, teammate and confidant Santiago Espinal said. When you have a family member, especially your sister, pass away and you come back and you do the things that he does, I mean, I don't know how to explain it, man. One thing that got me is that he came back from the DR and it was like he got to spend time with his family and came back over here and it's like, okay, back to business. I got to do my job now. Difficult in any walk of professional life, impossible for some. Unimaginable to those who know firsthand how hard this game is to play at this level when you consider what he's done. De La Cruz, who's 23, went home to the Dominican Republic, but only after playing one more series and using the June 5th off day to miss as little time as possible. He wound up not missing a game thanks to a fluke of a June 6th suspended game that was completed the next day when he came off the bench. It just shows who he is as a player and a person, said first base coach Colin Cowgill, who works closely with De La Cruz through his role as a base running coach. He's got some physical toughness, some mental toughness that lots of people don't possess. Toughness? De La Cruz, who's from a close-knit family, very close, Espinal said, is 17 for 45, which is .378, with 5 home runs and 4 doubles with as many walks, 9, as strikeouts, and was 3 for 4 in stolen base attempts in the 2 weeks since losing his sister. Those numbers were capped by his June 15th performance, when he went 3 for 5 and homered in his 4th straight game in the Reds' 8-4 victory over the Tigers. That raised De La Cruz's average to .273 with 16 home runs and 50 RBI this season. How? Just have the same mentality every day, De La Cruz said. Stay positive and try to win every game. Sometimes things don't go your way, but you've got to keep fighting. Keep fighting. A lot easier said than done. You just have to be the same guy every day. You can't change, he said. He also has the support of his family, who encouraged him to stay on the field. Sometimes when things like that happen in your life, baseball is kind of a nice distraction from that, Cowgill said. Sometimes through hardships, if you can focus on the task at hand in the moment, sometimes that's one of the greatest gifts, coming to the yard, being with your teammates, being with the people who love you. Stuff like that's hard. Being a human being in this game is hard. People forget that. Suter went through a family loss recently, taking bereavement leave last week to be with family after the death of his grandmother. We're all dealing with loss in life at points, and he just dealt with a very big loss, very big, Suter said. My grandma was 95. It was her time. She lived a full life. It was more of a celebration. That was not the case at all for Dela Cruz's family. What he's done in her memory, he's obviously playing with her on his heart every day, is nothing short of just awe-inspiring. Dela Cruz, a first-time All-Star last season, in his first full season in the big leagues, on June 14th made a 98.5-mile-per-hour relay throw from right field to cut down a runner at the plate and an early-game tone-setter for a victory over the MLB-best Detroit Tigers, and later homered for the third consecutive game. It's amazing to see what he does, and it's more amazing to be his teammate and to be right next to him and see what he does, and to be able to have these conversations with him and how he feels and stuff like that, Espinal said. You can ask, how does he do it out there when somebody close to him passes away, especially his sister? I don't know, Espinal said. Talking to my wife, I say, I don't know how he's doing it without literally missing a game. I think it was good that he went home. He seems to be doing really well, said manager Terry Francona, who's kept an eye on Dela Cruz's demeanor since his return and all but shook his head at the fact that Dela Cruz didn't want to miss a start. I think he probably has a pretty good support system in general, the manager said. He's just a very nice, happy kid, and I think he knows a lot of people care about him. That's been a mutual theme of the Dela Cruz career, at least since he debuted 2 years ago. He cares a lot about this baseball team. He cares a lot about the players in the locker room, Calgill said. He showed that time and time again. But in a true time of hardship, being able to spend time with his family, but then also showing the importance of being back here and being a baseball player and playing for something that, for him, is probably bigger than itself, his family wants him to play, and he wants to honor that too. I think he's doing a really good job of doing both those things, being a great baseball player and also being a great brother and son, Calgill said. It's really hard to do. It just shows how special of not just a ball player, but a human being he is. Our next story is by Gay Blacks, and it's headlined, Roaring Atop AL, Tigers, a Complete Team Now. They have been machine-like for more than 120 games spanning two seasons, and now sport the best record in the American League. Yet, peel back a layer from the Detroit Tigers, and the players responsible for that excellence aren't far removed from the pitfalls of the sport. Perhaps it was the extra baggage number one overall picks carry, a weight Spencer Torkelson admits delayed his eventual rise to feared slugger, or the isolation one can feel as a flailing superstar with a $140 million contract on a struggling team, like Javi Baez endured for most of three seasons. Not even the greatest Tiger of all, peerless left-hander Tarek Skubal, is immune, undergoing Tommy John surgery at his no-name college, climbing to the big leagues only to suffer a flexor tendon injury that wiped out nearly a full season of his prime. Yet look at them now. The Tigers are 46-27 going into the week, a start so dominant that the last Detroit club to break so strongly reached the 2006 World Series. The Tigers are a curious mix of largely 20-something talent, versatile and fungible youngsters, and the occasional veteran like World Series champion Baez, all willing to play anywhere or bet in whatever position, so long as everything they have is for the team. Torkelson, their first baseman, possibly headed to his first All-Star game, tells USA Today Sports, having these guys that have been at the bottom and those that have been at the top, like Javi, it's such a cool perspective. That's baseball. That's sports. It's not going to be amazing every single day, every single year. You're going to battle through it. For me, that's what's so rewarding about it. You've seen the worst, and when you do have success, it makes it that much sweeter. The franchise can relate. A 114-loss 2019 was the nadir during seven consecutive losing seasons, a stretch of futility that netted it the top overall pick in two drafts. It wasn't until this spring that those two number one overall picks, Torkelson and right-hander Casey Mize, found concurrent success. This is definitely a game of failure, says Riley Green, the Tigers' all-star outfielder. They worked on the things that needed work on, and they're crushing it now. Some people don't get it right away, and others do, but that's the ups and downs of baseball. They had stuff to work on, and they took it and ran with it, and now look at them. For Torkelson, the unkindest cut of all came when it least expected it. After spending all of 2023 in Detroit, the Tigers shipped him to Class AAA Toledo on June 3, 2024. He was toting a 201, 266, 330 slash line, which is four homers and 56 strikeouts and 230 plate appearances. It would have been humbling for any player who fancied himself a big league regular, but carrying that first overall pick designation, a tag no one ever forgets, only added to the weight. So Torkelson, still just 25, even as he's 5 years removed from the Tigers taking him number one out of Arizona State, learned to leave all that behind. A lot of it was eliminating expectations. As a people pleaser, I wanted to make everyone happy, says Torkelson. As a number one pick, you want to live up to what everyone's writing about you rather than take a step back and be like, wait, what got me selected number one? My God-given ability and work ethic got me selected. So why not trust that, which is a lot easier said than done. Really going back to the basics and doing it not for anyone else but my own pleasure. The mindset paid off. Torkelson earned an August recall to Detroit and produced a 781 OPS over the final 2 months compared to 597 before his demotion. He's continued the trend this season. His 16 home runs tops among AL first basemen. He also leads the majors with 10 two-strike home runs, possibly a testament to his adjusted mindset. Baseball or golf, it's like staying out of your own way is probably the biggest key to success for guys, says Torkelson. The goal is to stay as present as possible. As a baseball player, your mind is always looking forward. You get a hit, now you're 3 for 4. You get another home run, now you got 17. Your mind is always trying to look into the future, which it's supposed to do. But that's not how you maintain in a sport. It's taking a step back and seeing how you attack this pitch. Sometimes you catch yourself and you get yourself going back to present, says manager A.J. Hinch. The way he bounces back from tough at-bats, it's pretty resilient. Torkelson's recall, combined with a trade deadline makeover and Hinch unleashing the Tigers' pitching chaos plan, awakened a franchise. The Tigers finished 33-16, snagged a wild card spot, and upset the Astros in the wild card round before losing a wild five-game AL division series to Cleveland. And Baez wasn't around for almost all of it. He and the Tigers decided he'd have a season-ending hip injury after an August series at Wrigley Field, the site of Baez's greatest triumphs as a member of the 2016 World Series champion Chicago Cubs. With the Tigers, he'd been more a liability, producing a 221 OBP and 71 adjusted OPS in his first three seasons. Repairing his hip might have been the unkindest cut at the time, but now he and the Tigers are reaping the rewards. Baez returned healthy and with a new identity, the do-anything super utility man. Baez hadn't played center field since winter ball in 2015 until Hinch tossed him out there as a late-game defensive replacement. He ended up playing 23 consecutive games in center, robbing home runs, chasing balls into the gap, and in that span slugging six home runs with an 898 OPS. With center fielder Parker Meadows' return, Baez is more often back at his natural shortstop. Either way, he has been remarkably valuable. His 1.8 WAR per Baseball Reference, putting him on pace for his finest season as a Tiger. A guy like Javi, who's been the center part of a lot of teams he's been on, can be just one of the guys, Hinch says, who made two All-Stars teams and won a Gold Glove and Silver Slugger as a Cub. He doesn't have to carry us. We have a true team and a lot of guys who can do it. But when he adds something to the mix, we usually win. He's a big part of what we're doing, and I think he's one of the best versatile players in the league. Baez's production fused with the young core was the outcome he envisioned when he signed with the Tigers, the last major transaction of former general manager Al Avila's tenure. Everything is getting better as a team, as an organization. The only difference for me is being healthy, says Baez, whose deal runs through 2027. I'm playing better for myself and playing better for the team. That was one of the reasons I came here. I saw the other prospects coming here and would make a good team in the future. The future's now. We're doing it right now. Baez might have been envisioned as a franchise hub, but he's probably serving as a better avatar for the young players in his current role. Versatile, willing to trot out to any position, starter or reserve, always ready. He's unbelievable. He's one of the best athletes, baseball players, that I've got to see live, says Torkelson. You stick him in center field, he'd probably win a gold glove out there. He's such a great athlete and special to see every day. He's willing to do whatever, and he's so comfortable in whatever situation he's in. He's never sped up. He's always cool, calm, and collected, something we aspire to every game. As the season unfolds, the Tigers will have to accept their new lot in life, that of division favorites. They held a 9-game lead in the AL Central at press time, and with the rampant inconsistency in the AL West, they would be a fair bet to earn a first-round bye should they hold on to the division. Promising right-hander Jackson Jobe has been lost to Tommy John surgery, a big blow for his development, yet one the Tigers can weather given their depth with Scoobal, Jack Flaherty, and Mize out front of the rotation. Mize, the number one pick in 2018, already weathered that storm undergoing Tommy John and also back surgery, a double whammy that wiped out his entire 2023 season. We have Tarik leading us at the top. He's the best pitcher in the league, says Mize, who had a 2.95 ERA in 11 starts. And we have some depth we really like, and the bullpen guys we really like, a complete team. One that's on the verge of what could be an unforgettable summer, the promise of greatness tempered by the humility that helped them reach this threshold. What got us to this point is taking it day by day, being there for each other and enjoying the ride, says Torkelson. It's not going to be perfect, but it is going to be a lot of fun. Our next story is also by Gabe Blacks, and it's on the hottest topic of the last 3 days in the baseball world. The headline is Giants Steal Superstar from Red Sox. Blockbuster mid-June trade is almost an oxymoron in Major League Baseball, especially involving two elite franchises, both still in contention and trying to chase down their arch rivals. That's why the swap sending Rafael Devers from the Boston Red Sox to the San Francisco Giants is much more than a shocker. The ramifications of this deal will be felt for the next decade, likely through both organizations, with immediate impacts that will frame the final 90 games for both playoff hopefuls. A look at the winners and losers from perhaps the biggest, earliest in-season trade since Mike Piazza was shipped off by the Los Angeles Dodgers back in May of 1998. Winners. The Giants. Oh, what winners. The Giants have been rebuffed in both trade and free agent negotiations over the past decade by, take a deep breath, John Lester, Giancarlo Stanton, Aaron Judge, Shohei Ohtani, Carlos Correa's right fibula, and who knows how many more we may not know about. Now, they don't have to worry about being used as stalking horses come next winter. Devers is under contract for 8 more seasons and a $238.5 million contract, plus the roughly $15 million owed for the remainder of this year and a $2 million reassignment bonus. If you ask the Giants if they could acquire for 8-plus years and about $2.5 million, I'm sorry, $250 million, a 2-time silver slugger who averaged 32 home runs and an 873 OPS the past 4 seasons as one of the best left-handed bat swings in the game and is just 28 years old, how soon would they say yes? Sure, the Giants gave up young lefty Kyle Harrison, scuffling veteran Jordan Hicks, who has struggled to toggle between rotation and relief in recent years, and 2024 first-round pick James Tibbs, who has an 857 OPS at high A, yet at 22 isn't exactly young for that circuit. All these elements are replaceable. Luring an elite bat to San Francisco has proved almost impossible, and one just fell into the Giants' lap. Buster Posey? It was an eye-opener when he elevated himself with ownership's blessing to the number one baseball job just 4 years removed from the playing field. Sure, he's a smart and passionate baseball man, but how would this executive onboarding go? Well, Posey's proved he's not afraid to roll the dice and burn a wad of ownership's money. The Giants have gone from dark horse to legit contender this year. Their record of 41-31 through June 15th is a mix of Farhad Zahidi holdovers, Posey tweaks, and perhaps the greatest sense of clarity and purpose that can come with a future Hall of Famer pushing the buttons. Posey just solved their missing superstar problem. He also bought a ton of goodwill from San Francisco fans who already idolized him and would be ready to deify him if he gets the squad back to the World Series. Willie Adames. It's been a struggle going from Milwaukee's hitter-friendly park to San Francisco, where fly balls are gobbled up in the marine layer. A 202 average and 81 adjusted OPS were tough bags to carry with a recently signed $182 million contract. Well, all of a sudden, Adames is no longer the highest paid nor riskiest Giant acquisition. Additionally, sliding between Devers and presumably a healthy Matt Chapman in the lineup will take a lot of heat off and enhance the quality of pitches he sees. Alex Bregman, the man who started all of this, is probably going to get a whole lot richer. Bregman signed a 3-year, $120 million deal with a pair of opt-outs, creating the logjam that resulted in Devers' bruised feelings, the Red Sox fumbling of the situation, and the ultimate trade of Devers to the Giants. And since joining Boston, he has made Fenway Park his playground with 11 homers, a 938 OPS, and a 3.0 WAR in just 51 games, though a quad injury will keep him out until roughly the end of this month. Now, imagine the ire in Boston if the Red Sox both trade Devers and fail to retain Bregman. The Red Sox just opened up a bunch of cash to bestow on Bregman and also created greater need to keep him. Ka-ching! Rafael Devers. So maybe it was never going to work out after the spring training flap about moving to DH and the in-season flap about moving to first base in the wake of Tristan Casas' season-ending injury. Yet, after a slow start, Devers has done nothing but mash for the Red Sox with 15 homers, a 905 OPS, and a nice parting gift, a home run off Max Fried to ensure the Red Sox 2-0 win and sweep of the Yankees. Now, he gets a chance to hit the refresh button and begin a new relationship with a different regime. The Red Sox did not worry about hurting Devers' feelings in spring when manager Alex Cora noted that Devers' $313 million contract was signed under a different manager, different general manager, that is. He faces an odd situation in San Francisco. The great Matt Chapman will be out until around the All-Star break with a hand injury, leaving third base vacant. The club just cut loose first baseman Lamont Wade, with a long-term vacancy looming there. Would Devers consider bouncing from third base back to DH or try learning a new position at first base with a new club? The Red Sox would certainly smirk themselves to death if he did so. But this is a fresh start. The ball is in his court. Now for the losers. The Red Sox. Elite hitters simply aren't easy to replace. In a cynical sense, the Red Sox harvested what they needed out of Devers. Signed him out of the Dominican Republic at 16, won a World Series with him 5 years later, retained him with a nine-figure deal after the embarrassment of the Mookie Betts trade, and then moved on. But no matter how many highly rated hitting prospects you hoard, there's simply no substitute for a veteran slugger who hits 30 home runs, falling out of bed, and up to 38 in a career year. Boston will bear the nonlinear growing pains of its new core over the next few years, and, like Betts, may be cursed with trying in vain to replace Rafi in coming years. Craig Breslow. To be sure, the Red Sox second-year president of baseball operations will have to own this one, just like his predecessor, Chaim Bloom, will forever be the man who traded Mookie. The stealth attack nature of this deal, literally the entire industry was blindsided until just a few minutes before 7 p.m. Eastern Time, June 15th, means Breslow pulled it off in silence, but he also didn't get an overwhelming return to get to rid the Red Sox of Devers, that's Devers, of course, and his contract. There's a decent chance the Red Sox traded a cornerstone for a swingman, lefty, Harrison, a flame-throwing reliever, Hicks, and a pair of minor league lottery tickets. From a return standpoint, Tibbs is probably the key. He has an 857 OPS and just 45 strikeouts at high A, but turns 23 in October and has several hurdles before bringing his lefty bat to Fenway. In a year or two, there'll be a better overall read of Breslow's tenure. Should the guys acquired in the deal fail to pop and the Red Sox scuffle in Devers' absence, the tote board won't look so great for Breslow. That great young Red Sox core would be a credit to his predecessor, Bloom, while the Breslow regime will be known as the group that couldn't coexist with a superstar, despite their highly publicized sortie to Kansas City to try to talk Devers into playing first. Roman Anthony, Marcelo Meyer, Christian Campbell. Ah, yes, that great young core. This is exactly what they didn't need as all three embark on what should be fantastic careers. All are now with the big club and displaying the bouts of brilliance and frustration that come with oh-so-young careers. Anthony, the game's greatest hitting prospect, was 1-for-17 in his first week, the one hit being a game-winning double. Meyer, the fantastic infielder, has a two-homer game, but also a 31% strikeout rate in only 54 appearances. Campbell, signed to an 8-year, $60 million deal in his first week in the majors, looked like an all-star for the first month, but has hit just 157, 239, 233 line in his last 134 plate appearances. Hey, all of that's just fine. The kids will develop in time and will need some on-ramp to realize their best versions of themselves. But you know what they didn't need? A lineup anchor dealt away just as the club was getting hot, turning the glare of the fan base to this young trio that's expected to be the future and increasingly the present. They will surely be what they will be, and in all three cases that may very well be greatness, but a challenging major league assimilation just got a lot tougher. All right, let's take a break from baseball stories and turn to the National Football League with the cover story, Worst to First, Ranking 8 Teams Odds. This story is by Michael Middlehurst Swartz. For just the third time in the last 22 years, the NFL in 24 didn't have a team go from worst to first within a division. But don't declare parity dead yet. Look no further than the Washington Commanders for the example that has provided hope to much of the rest of the league throughout the offseason. After going 4-13 in 2023, the franchise opted to wipe the slate clean, bringing aboard coach Dan Quinn, general manager Adam Peters, and quarterback Jaden Daniels. Most figured that such an extensive reworking would lead to a transition season, but Washington rocketed to a 12-5 mark and an appearance in the NFL championship game. Now, as teams prepare to break for the summer, many of the league's incumbent cellar dwellers are holding out hope. Here is our ranking of the league's 8 last-place finishers based on the likelihood that they can pull off a worst-to-first transformation this fall. Number 1, San Francisco 49ers. What's working for them? Having reached at least the conference championship game 4 times and won the division 3 times in the 5 years prior to last season, San Francisco clearly has a solid foundation that so many others on this list lack. That starts at both coach, where Kyle Shanahan's adroit play calling confers a massive advantage, and quarterback, with Brock Purdy reaching a 5-year, $265 million extension that hardly seems lofty. The 2024 edition of the squad was snake-bitten, so getting back the likes of Christian McCaffrey, Brandon Ayuk, and Trent Williams after the injury-riddled seasons is sure to fuel an offensive upswing. The defense also has hopes for better days ahead, too, with Robert Saleh sizing up as the right man to clean up various issues as he begins his second stint as coordinator with the organization. The NFC West seems at least somewhat manageable to navigate after having the smallest gap in wins, 5 games, between any division's championship and the last place finisher. Now, what's working against them? There's been significant attrition, especially on a defense that needs several young replacements, especially along the defensive line, to step up. With Aliyuk still working his way back from a torn anterior cruciate and medial collateral ligament, and Debo Samuel Sr. traded to the Commanders, second-year receiver Ricky Pearsall will have to make a sizable mark to keep the passing game going. Rediscovering a finishing touch will be essential after the 49ers were outscored 165-88 in the fourth quarter and had a dreadful result in the red zone on both sides of the ball. The NFC West doesn't offer any easy outs either, and the Los Angeles Rams shouldn't be expected to slide. The bottom line, there's enough change in the last 12 months that an immediate return to form is hardly a foregone conclusion. But this version of the 49ers might have what it takes to reclaim the divisional crown, even if it has ceded its place as the definitive favorite. Okay, number two, Tennessee Titans. What's working for them? Cam Ward might not have cleared the cliched bar of a generational quarterback prospect, but it's easy to see why Titans brass figured he could be a transformative figure for the franchise. In combining high-end pocket poise with unique out-of-structure ability, he can immediately recalibrate the offense. That would be offense. The offensive line also looks to be as solid as it has been in years, thanks to the signings of left tackle Dan Moore Jr. and right guard Kevin Zeitler. New special teams coordinator John Fassel, widely regarded as one of the league's most innovative minds in his concentration, should clean up the rampant mistakes. With the Jacksonville Jaguars and the Indianapolis Colts undergoing major adjustments, and the Houston Texans yet to fully assert themselves, the AFC South seems more open than many other divisions. Now, what's working against the Titans? Handing the keys over to a rookie typically entails a series of setbacks, and Ward has several over-aggressive tendencies that will need to be tamped down in order to avoid a repeat of last season. But it might be the defense that ultimately drags this group down. Tennessee simply didn't do enough to upgrade a group that ranked 30th in scoring, and it undoubtedly will cost them in the short term. And while the Texans might not be world beaters, they don't need to be in top form to remain several notches above the Titans. Bottom line, even with the most fortuitous circumstances, the Titans will be hard-pressed to vault all the way to the top of the AFC South. Number three, Chicago Bears. What's working for them? New head coach and play caller Ben Johnson could revolutionize the Bears' long stagnant attack. Caleb Williams weathered the calamitous conditions of his rookie season about as admirably as anyone could ask, and his abundant creativity could finally be unlocked by Johnson. And between the overhauling of the interior line and the continued boosting of the receiving corps, there's room for this group to make a seismic leap in the fall. On defense, coordinator Dennis Allen should be a steadying force, especially as Johnson learns the ropes of handling the top job. So what's working against the Bears? Well, don't assume it will all click right away. How Williams handles the demands Johnson places on operating within structure and on schedule will bear watching, as it could be an early pain point. Meanwhile, merely importing several veterans up front might not be a cure-all after Chicago posted a league-worst sack rate of nearly 10%. With the NFC North featuring three playoff teams, two of which vied for the conference's number one seed in the final week, it'd take almost everything hitting right for Chicago to climb past all of the competition. Their bottom line? Johnson's appeal stems not only from his play-calling acumen, but also his ability to implement a culture refresh. Bears fans should keep the latter point in mind as the organization makes progress that might not be linear or lead to the mountaintop by the end of the coach's debut season. Number four, New England Patriots. What's working for them? In flocking to free agency to patch holes throughout the roster, the Patriots made clear they expect to return to at least the precipice of a postseason competition. Mike Vrabel is a fitting choice to take on that task, and the former Titans coach no doubt will be looking to restore a culture of accountability. The drumbeat regarding the upward trajectory of Drake May's development has only amplified throughout the offseason, and the installation of Josh McDaniels' more streamlined offense and the addition of several formidable weapons, receivers Stephon Diggs and Kyle Williams, as well as running back Trayvon Henderson, should only accelerate the quarterback's ascent. But the personnel overhauls might provide the most immediate returns on defense, where defensive end Milton Williams, cornerback Carlton Davis III, and linebacker Robert Spillane can be difference makers. What's working against the Pats? Well, for all the change here, was enough done to lift up an offensive line that repeatedly let May and the running game down? First-round left tackle Will Campbell sparked plenty of questions regarding whether he can hang on the blind side against NFL edge rushers, and the other additions weren't exactly splashy. Even if the front does eventually come together, it might take some time before a group that ranked 31st in ESPN's pass block win rate metric and last in run block win rate finds its footing. An edge rush counting on castoffs, that is, Harold Landry III and Kevon Chaisson to provide a boost remains lackluster at best. And barring a long-term injury to Josh Allen, the Bills seem to have more than enough to again trample the rest of the division. The bottom line, lots of new pieces here. How quickly they will all coalesce will determine the extent of the year one improvement. Bet on a boost, perhaps even to the level of relevance in the wildcard race, but don't get carried away. Number 5, the New Orleans Saints. What's working for them? The Saints are embarking on a new path rather than repeatedly doubling down on an aging and costly roster, with Kellen Moore taking over as the NFL's youngest head coach. The pivot begins behind center, where rookie Tyler Shough seems to have the inside track to replace Derek Carr after the veteran's retirement. The second-round signal caller has the arm strength and confidence to take advantage of arguably the league's speediest receiving corps, featuring downfield blazers Chris Olave, Rashid Shaheed, and Brandon Cooks. Also, the NFC South seems far more fluid than most other divisions. What's working against the Saints? There's a sizable amount of cap work still to be done in the coming years before a clean slate will come into sight. Given his struggles to make snap decisions, he could be in for a shock to the system as he adjusts to NFL speed, a problem that could be exacerbated by the Saints' uneven offensive line. The aerial attack also might struggle to find its form if Olave, perhaps that's Olave, again misses substantial time after sitting out 9 games last year. The 30th-ranked defense will have to depend on new coordinator Brandon Staley to cover for its myriad shortcomings, especially in a suspect secondary bound to feel the sting of Paulson Adebo's departure. And it seems unlikely that the Tampa Bay Buccaneers' division grasp will loosen anytime soon. The bottom line, more likely it will have to endure some tough times before the franchise can launch its true reset in earnest. Number 6, the Las Vegas Raiders. What's working for them? If the Raiders' core aim is to establish baseline competitiveness, Pete Carroll and Geno Smith seem to be fitting leaders for that mission. With Chip Kelly designing the offense, the coach and quarterback could rekindle the spark that allowed them to defy expectations in Seattle. Heisman Trophy runner-up Ashon Jonte's arrival should immediately change the complexion of a historically putrid ground game, while the receiving core added pieces to lighten the load on Brooke Bowers and move on from the disappointing Devontae Adams era. What's working against them? If Kansas City's 9-year claim to the AFC West is to come to an end in 2025, the Los Angeles Chargers and Denver Broncos, both returning playoff outfits, would be the natural candidates to assume the top spot. Las Vegas was one of only 2 teams to go winless in its division last season, and an overall talent deficiency will be hard to compensate for. That particularly seems the case on defense, where a unit that doesn't offer much beyond Max Crosby will be relying on several veteran stopgap solutions. The Raiders' bottom line? They should take a page from Carroll and focus on competing against themselves rather than measuring their progress against the AFC West competitors. though closing the gap would certainly constitute a significant win. Number 7, the New York Giants. What's working for them? Well, while the Giants resisted blowing things up at the very top of the organization, the team took a far more aggressive tack to reconfigure the quarterback room, which welcomed Russell Wilson, Jameis Winston, and first-rounder Jackson Dart. With Wilson set to take over as starter, Big Blue will no doubt be more aggressive in attacking downfield. With Malik Nabers and Darius Slayton looking more than up to the task of hauling in the veteran signature moon balls. More big plays also seem in store for a defense that fortified its greatest strength in its pass rush, as adding Abdul Carter alongside Brian Byrne and Kayvon Thibodeau could make this one of the league's most effective crews at creating chaos. And if Dexter Lawrence again plays at a level that will put him in a conversation for NFL Defensive Player of the Year, New York's front could be a legitimate problem. What's working against them? Wilson didn't prove to be a tenable starting option for the Pittsburgh Steelers team that offered far more support than New York does. If the Giants fall in an early hole, how long will Brian Daboll keep Dart on the shelf? A shoddy offensive line looks ill-equipped to support either option and could spoil any visions of a more prolific passing game. Then there's the matter of the NFC East, between the Eagles and Commanders being entrenched as established contenders, and the Cowboys possibly in line for a bounce back, the climb out of the basement appears steep. Bottom line, short of Wilson engineering a stunning late-career renaissance, or Dart getting an early look and dazzling, there's not enough ammo here for a substantial turnaround. And number 8, Cleveland Browns. What's working for them? Deshaun Watson's ineffectiveness and Jameis Winston's interception-happy play proved to be an anchor, leaving the once-dominant defense repeatedly saddled with unfavorable situations. With mainstay left guard Joel Bitonio indicating earlier in June that the Kevin Stefanski-helmed attack looks due to get back to its run-centric roots, even small strides in efficiency for a group that tied for the NFL lead with 34 giveaways could have a significant ripple effect. Myles Garrett and Denzel Ward remain elite presences on defense, and first-round defensive tackle Mason Graham and second-round linebacker Carson Swessenshire helped provide the youthful backing that went missing in recent years with the team's draft capital sapped by the Watson trade. What's working against the Browns? Even if the ask of the passing game is minimized, how reasonable is it to count on the ground game to rediscover its previous form, given how unstable the front has been and the loss of offensive line coach Bill Callahan? Linebacker Jeremiah Owusu-Koromoa, already being ruled out for the season as he continues to recover from a neck injury, seems like a bad harbinger. The AFC North landscape is nothing short of treacherous. The bottom line, with general manager Andrew Berry passing up the chance to take Travis Hunter in order to add another first rounder for 2026, it feels as though the franchise is admitting its focus has advanced beyond this season. And now another NFL story focusing on second-year guys who need to step up. This is also by Michael Middlehurst Schwartz. An NFL player's rookie season can set a course for his professional career, but year two is hardly too late to blaze a new path. When even the likes of Jaden Daniels and Brock Bowers flourish almost immediately, instantaneous success can be difficult to come by in the NFL for first-year players. Many of the most accomplished draft picks spend their inaugural campaigns getting up to speed with their playbooks and adjusting to a higher level of competition, leaving them ill-equipped to showcase their full skill set. But a horde from the 2024 draft class is now learning how vital the first full offseason as part of a team can be, as there's ample time to adjust after slipping up or receiving limited opportunities. Here are 9 second-year players who need to step up this fall after rough rookie season. Caleb Williams, quarterback, Chicago Bears. What's left to say about one of the most tumultuous starts in some time for a historically hyped passer? With Ben Johnson coming aboard as head coach and play caller, and the interior offensive line reconstructed with proven veterans, The number one pick looked poised to leave last season fully behind him. But details released from the forthcoming book by ESPN's Seth Wickersham, who reported Williams and his father sought to find a way to avoid the Bears, served as a reminder just how hard it will be for both the quarterback and the organization to shake off the past. The controversy hasn't killed the good vibes of a Bears offseason that was nothing short of transformative. With Johnson calling the shots, Williams will have someone who not only can drill down on the finer points of quarterback play and schematic concerns, but also a figure who wants to turn the attack loose. That mentality should gel well with that of the 2022 Heisman Trophy winner, whose preternatural sense for igniting big plays was often canceled out by the wider ineptitude of the league's last-ranked offense. Questions remain about how Williams will embrace playing on a schedule and within structure, given how rhythmic Johnson's prolific offenses for the Lions were. But after taking a league-worst 68 sacks last season, Williams should be eager to minimize punishment in the early going by taking advantage of quick hits and boosting his league-low checkdown rate of 7.1%, according to Pro Football Focus. And with massive improvements in protection, as well as the expected strides that the rejuvenated receiving corps support, shouldn't be a pressing question anymore. Marvin Harrison, Jr., wide receiver with the Cardinals. By any measure, a rookie season that entailed 885 receiving yards and 8 touchdown catches can hardly be considered failure. But Harrison has been dealing with outside expectations his entire life, and in a year that was shaped by the breakout performances of fellow first-year receivers Malik Nabers and Brian Thomas Jr., the son of Hall of Famer Marvin Harrison, didn't clear the sky-high bar that accompanied him in the NFL as the number 4 pick. After Harrison had a stunningly quiet introduction in the NFL with one catch on 3 targets, Kyler Murray frequently seemed to force the issue with his new standout pass catcher. The result? Harrison hauled in just 62 of his 116 targets, with the off-kilter chemistry between Murray and the Ohio State product requiring further work. Noticeably bulked up this offseason, Harrison might already be better positioned to handle the contested catch scenarios that became all too routine in 2024. But fostering a better connection with Murray would go a long way toward unlocking all the possibilities that Harrison's superlative route running can open up for the offense. Static usage also weighed down on Harrison's impact, and offensive coordinator Drew Petzing should be under pressure to be more creative in his deployment of the receiver so as to spark more opportunities in space. Also with the Cardinals, Darius Robinson, defensive end. When Robinson was picked with the number 27 overall pick, it was widely understood that the 6'5", 285-pounder would take time to translate his considerable physical tools into consistent production. But after a strong start in training camp, he suffered a calf injury in August that would sideline him for all but the last 6 games of the season. With his mother dying in October, Robinson later called it the hardest year of my life. A busy Cardinals offseason brought a robust investment in the defense, with Josh Sweat, Dalvin Tomlinson, Calais Campbell, and first-rounder Walter Nolan III all coming aboard to boost Jonathan Gannon's pass rush. But Robinson's forcefulness should remain a vital asset for the front, given that the defense ranked 28th in ESPN's pass rush win rate metric and was middling against the run. The arrival of Campbell could prove to be a particular boon to Robinson's development. The 6-time Pro Bowler learned how to get the most out of his massive frame at 6'8 and 307 pounds, and his tutelage should help Robinson develop a better pass rush plan and more comfort using counters. Next is Tyler Guyton, offensive tackle for the Cowboys. A rough transition to the professional level seemed inevitable for Guyton, a 6'8, 322-pound former H-back who offered an enticing package of athleticism but lacked the refinement to engender much trust as a rookie as he flipped from right tackle to the left side. The number 29 overall pick started 11 games for the Cowboys and proved to be a weak link in the line, committing 18 penalties while struggling mightily in both pass protection and run blocking. I'm not going to make any excuses, Guyton said during OTAs. I just didn't play as good as I needed last year. I'm coming with a different attitude this year to become a better player. His commitment has drawn the attention of Dallas's new coaching staff, with head coach Brian Schottenheimer saying Guyton has had a terrific offseason. Offensive coordinator Clayton Adams, who helped the Cardinals build a punishing identity up front despite underwhelming overall talent, should be a major asset for a player behind the curve on a positional know-how. Crafty edge rushers still could pose a problem, and there are plenty waiting on the Cowboys' schedule. But the arrow is decidedly pointed in the right direction for Guyton's trajectory heading into training camp. Next is Xavier Leggett, wide receiver with the Panthers. In the lead-up to this year's draft, Dave Canales repeatedly backed Leggett despite the number 32 overall pick, having his rookie season largely defined by his 7 drops, including one that doomed the Panthers' push for a December upset of the Philadelphia Eagles. Then, Carolina took wide receiver Tetteroa McMillan with the number 8 overall pick in April. Within a year, a player who once looked central to quarterback Bryce Young's development now appeared to be shunted to the side. Canales, however, isn't taking that viewpoint, even with McMillan aboard. I think, you know, with T-Mac coming into the room, again, it's just options, Canales said in May, according to the Panthers site. It opens things up, and it creates a little bit of balance where the field doesn't tilt one way or the other. So you have two guys who can make it happen outside, and that's a good thing. The connection between Young, who was benched in Week 2 but resumed his starting spot after filling in for injured Andy Dalton later in the season, and Leggett, was clearly off throughout the 24 campaign, with the receiver hauling in just 49 of his team-leading 84 targets. Leggett didn't play a leading role in the blossoming of the downfield passing attack later in the year, as the pass catcher never had more than 60 yards in a game after Week 3. Meanwhile, undrafted free agent Jalen Coker cleared that bar 4 times for the Panthers last fall. Between the arrival of McMillan and the emergence of Coker, Leggett looks unlikely to operate as the true number one receiver some might have hoped he would become, with a downtick in his target share more likely in order this season. But the 6'3", 227-pounder remains an imposing matchup as a vertical threat, and a more robust receiving core should allow Young to attack defenses in a more complete manner after plenty of challenges to start his career. Ultimately, the year two outcome might hinge on whether his back-to-basics offseason work on his catching with his hands rather than his body helps Leggett secure the big plays that fell through his fingertips last season. Next is Jalen Polk, wide receiver with the Patriots. The arrival of a new coaching staff can often spell trouble for young players coming off a disappointing season, with the new regime typically not placing much weight on previous investments of draft capital. While the hiring of Mike Vrabel could produce a necessary reset, Polk should be on alert as he tries to prove himself after a woeful professional debut. The number 37 pick in last year's draft posted just 12 receptions for 87 yards on 33 targets. Adding to the sting, the Patriots could have grabbed Ladd McConkey, who led the Los Angeles Chargers with 1,149 yards last season, but instead traded back 3 spots and nabbed Polk. With New England adding Stephon Diggs and third-rounder Kyle Williams to the receiving corps, it hardly seems as though the team is content to bide its time for a player who still has far to go to provide a meaningful boost to quarterback Drake May. Maybe the hire of Josh McDaniels and a more streamlined offense will point Polk toward greater contributions this fall. With May gaining more confidence and the unit better equipped to attack downfield, the 6'1", 205-pound receiver might have more opportunities to leverage his skills operating in contested catch scenarios. But given his first impression and how the team responded, a turnaround is far from a guarantee. Next is Adonai Mitchell, a wide receiver with the Colts. Freeing himself from coverage has never been a problem for Mitchell. The 6'2", 205-pound target routinely snapped off quick changes of direction to shake cornerbacks or merely raced past them with his 91 open score in ESPN's receiver metrics, tying him for ninth in the league with Tariq Hill and Zay Flowers. Capitalizing on those opportunities was another matter entirely. The second-round pick from Texas brought in just 23 of his 55 targets for 312 yards. Much of that could be traced back to quarterback Anthony Richardson, who completed just 47.7% of his passes last year and repeatedly overthrew Mitchell when the receiver was in prime position downfield. But some of the on-field problems that prompted his surprising tumble to day two of the draft, including inconsistent precision and urgency, flared up again. "He's just young," Colts general manager Chris Ballard said after the season. "Like any young player, there's going to be a maturation process with him. And he has some definitely really strong moments, but we need more consistent moments from him." For Mitchell, however, any path toward reaching those moments isn't very clear at this point. While the Colts primarily use Mitchell as a deep threat, Alec Pierce averaged a league-best 22.3 yards per reception in 24 in that capacity and could be a candidate for an extension. Indianapolis also returns two other receivers who eclipsed 800 yards in Michael Pittman Jr. and Josh Downs, and the offense will also be breaking in first-round tight end Tyler Warren. Unless an injury opens up an avenue for more playing time, a successful season might simply constitute sharpening his skill and earning more trust. And that concludes our reading of the sports news for this week. I thank you for your listening. Once again, this is Kent Batty, a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Have a good day. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org by left-clicking on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can now also listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.